I sure like having the tech guy in the class, so I don't have to talk behind his back.
Can't talk about me, I'm not doing it today.
If you're keeping up with the reading guide, if you have that, there you go, that's right, yeah, just grab one out of there right now. Anybody see a reading guide? Don't want to hand these out? Oh, good guy, thank you. We are up to chapters 3, 4, and 5. And the introduction of the sin problem. I would really like to begin by just brainstorming that with you. So tell me, what happens in chapters 3, 4, and 5? You could peek. There is a murder, a family murder. Chapter 4.
There's a serpent.
There's a snake story. Thank you.
Going.
What else? 3, 4, and 5.
Sorry? There's a genealogy.
Thank you for that courageous answer that nobody else was going to give. There are actually 3 genealogies, right? More than one. Y'all's favorite thing, the dreaded name list. Dude, are you drinking coffee?
You know what they said, it's cool. If you didn't bring one for everybody,
or one cup in there.
That's all right, I'll pass.
Hope Anthony's watching that over there. He may want to meet with you after some. What else?
Complicating incident.
Sorry?
The complicating incident.
The complicating incident?
The conflict of the story.
Yeah. Sorry, it's how you're going to be allowed from.
The conflict of the story.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. What else is in here?
Consequences.
There are consequences. Okay?
Offerings.
Do you mind if I just hijack that?
Yes, sir.
There's worship, right?
That's better.
Just bigger. Anything else you see in there?
Corruption.
Corruption? Thank you. Anything else you see in there?
A lot of eastward travel.
Where's Greeley? They said go west, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Eastward
travel.
There's interesting detail to yank right out of there.
There's communication of God, direct communication of God.
Okay. I'm at the bottom. I got room for one more. I was looking at you, so you go ahead. You're already in trouble anyway, so.
Nature of God.
Nature of God.
You start seeing the beginnings of who God is, expectations of God on man.
So we're learning, thank you for that, we're learning about the players, more about the players and who they are. I don't want to cut you out of this.
Oh, I'll get you off.
Okay, thank you.
Twice.
So, I do want you to kind of hang on to the idea that the Bible is telling a story, and this is the beginning of the story, doing the things that need to be done at the beginning of the story so we're able to follow it. So, in 1 and 2 last week, we talked about the characters. We're introduced to man and God and began to explore their characteristics. I think you're right. That continues here And I think that three begins in a dramatic way to expose the plot line of the story. So let me impose, thank you for all of this, let me impose a little structure over all of that, and this is how I kind of want to walk through it here in class. We begin with disobedience in 3:1 through 7. I think that was on our list, right? Did somebody say that?
Consequences.
Yeah, kind of. Well, and then immediately we go on to the consequences of the disobedience. Notice which gets more space, right? A little is actually told about the sin. A whole lot is told about what happened as a result of that. And then I think when you move into 4, a problem that's going to be dealt a lot with in this first 11 chapters, and that is the problem does not stay isolated. It grows and spreads and infects other people. And then we have these two amazing genealogies, right? Both from Adam, but through two different sons. The first one in chapter 4, verse 17, is through Cain, his family, and the next we go through Seth and through his family. So let's go to chapter 3, if you will. And let's start with, we'll just walk through these segments and talk about them a little bit. Tell me about the story of disobedience. What do you see here? Verses 1 through 7. Don't get ahead of me. Let's just work there for now.
Eve decides to listen to the serpent.
Okay. So this confrontation between Eve and the serpent. Who is the serpent? Yeah, the Bible clearly in Revelation 12:9 identifies, if there's any doubt about that, the serpent of old is the devil. There is this conflict. Thank you for that, Jill. Let's unpack that a little bit. What goes on?
Well, he misconstrues what God... First of all, he asks, do you know what God said? And then he twists it to make it less, I guess, direct and cast out.
Yeah. What did God say?
Don't eat the tree.
Or?
You'll die.
What did Satan say?
You won't die.
Like God. So, what does he do? What do we call that?
A lie.
Okay, he just lies to him. God said, the worst possible outcome if you eat this. Satan says, the best possible outcome if you eat this. You ever thought about that? What drew Eve to the fruit? Not just that it looked good, I know that.
It was like her like God.
Yeah. I don't think, see, I've always wondered about this. There's so many things when I read this story that just swirl around in my head. Like, would Eve really even know what it was to know, to have the knowledge of good and evil, if she had never had the knowledge of good and evil? I mean, I don't even know if that would register her, what that was. But the part that would register her is, you can be like God. Right? You can be like God. By the way, do y'all buy this, if I say this to you, that that is at the bottom the fundamental human struggle? I want to be in God's shoes.
Well, in the sense that I want to be in charge of my own destiny. I want to be in control.
I want to do what I want to do. I want to stand in God's shoes. See how much fundamental stuff is laid out right here at the beginning, right? And so, how easy should this decision have been, and why? Should it have been a pretty easy decision? What do you think?
Should have been. One rule, right? Don't eat of that tree. Pretty simple.
But she knows God. She's been, supposedly they've been around God, they've seen God, talked to God. They don't know who the serpent is.
Yeah, again, so many questions I have. And y'all, I mean, y'all could ask me, and we can have this fun game of you ask, and I say, I don't know. But what is it weird to her that a snake is talking to her? Right? I wonder about that. You know, some people jump off all these wild theories. Oh, you know, the animals talk with them. Like, well, you know, it doesn't say that in the text, except for this one. So, I don't know, but it's... You know, the text doesn't say, and Eve thought it was utterly bizarre that there was a talking snake in the garden. I mean, what is that about? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. Yeah. Kendrick says the answer. This is going out for the whole world. No. Zoom the camera in right here.
I do not have the answer. But I would say one thing that's coming to my mind here is if you go back to our lesson last week and how God set the order for the man was to have dominion. She let the serpent talk her into something.
So there is so much to unpack here, right? You know, we just typically read this as a story, but just almost every single verse has stuff about the big picture of the problem, the sin problem, right? And one of the things that you see going on there is the reversal of God's design, the reversal of the creative order, right? What's the creative order? After God, who's first?
Man,
Adam. And then Eve. And who rules over the animals?
Adam and Eve.
Adam and Eve. God, Adam, Eve, Satan. Yep. Until you get to chapter 3. And what's the order?
Opposite.
Satan, woman, Adam. It's a reversal of the creative order. So remember this. Whenever God sets something in order, and we don't work with the order as he said it, what happens?
Chaos.
Always, always bad. It doesn't work if we don't do it the way God designed it. So I think this should have been pretty easy, because whatever she did or didn't know about the Satan, what did she know about God?
He's number one.
He's number one? Sure. Listen, 61 guys. Y'all got to be louder. What else?
Her creator.
Sorry?
Her creator.
He's a creator.
Powerful.
Powerful.
He sets the rules.
Sets the rules.
She should have gone to her husband.
Yeah, not the order.
And then the husband failed by not protecting.
Does she have any evidence that God is good?
She has to know that he loves her. She's probably relying a lot on that.
What does she even know of bad?
I know. Isn't that interesting, right? But she's standing in the middle of the blessings, right? If nothing else, you can look at the garden paradise where everything is perfect, right? That's how we left it last week, right? You finished the creation process. Everything was very good. Everything was perfect. So she's in this perfect spot. You would think,
the grass
right?
is always greener on the other side.
And there is that fundamental human struggle. No matter how good I got it, I still want to stand in God's shoes. Yes, sir.
It's nice they took her for granted because they didn't know what bad was, so they just didn't.
Yeah, but I would think they would knew God could be trusted, right? There seems to me to be abundant evidence for that. But bizarrely, or is it bizarre, but because she hears him, and she chooses to hear the adversary.
So what does she know of death? Because he says the consequence is you'll die.
I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah,
I've got 1,000 questions about all of this, right? By the way, why doesn't God cover all this stuff for us?
Well, he said, do not do it. Because so if God is everything,
God had warned them of death, so he talked about that.
So when he says, "Do not do it," or unless you will die, I mean, that tends to be bad. If he doesn't want you to do something, you're going to die. Even though if I don't know what death is, it has to be bad because he doesn't want me to do it.
I buy that that's true. Going back to my question, guys, this book is not written to satisfy all my curiosities about reality in life. And people have to remember that or they're going to get into trouble. What is the book written to do?
Increase our faith.
Okay, yes.
Bring us back to God.
It's the redemption story. And everything in Genesis 3 is not about, oh, tell me what was happening back then. It's about what God is doing to bring about his purpose. and redeeming man. So we don't get all of our curiosity satisfied, much to my frustration. Yes, sir.
Let's say it. First of all, Satan said, basically, he cast out on God's intent. It didn't just say, oh, that's not true, do this instead. But he said, no, he knows what's going to happen if you do this. So, and, I mean, it's a minor thing, but it can make a difference in the mind.
Well, he also starts out by saying how restrictive God is. As he said, you can't eat from any tree.
Right. So he casts doubt on God's intent. And he... This is Satan, right? He's a supernatural. He knows a little bit more about them than they do, probably.
I would actually say that the words you mentioned, this is in verse 5, the first three words there may be the most important three words in the whole section. Because it's how Satan persuades her not to hear God. He's holding out on you. He's depriving you of something that's good. By the way, you realize that every willful sin works with that assumption? What do you think about that? Every willful sin works on the assumption God said this, but it isn't for my good. Don't trust God. Under every, listen, every time we cave to temptation and sin, we have said by our action, I don't really trust God. That's why over time, you see people that go down that route, it doesn't get better and better. It gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. Why? Because over time, you trust God less and less and less. That's why sin is such a terrible, terrible thing. Okay, so she eats the fruit. She gives to Adam. He eats it too. And in verse 8, we begin this link. That's the rest of the chapter. We get this lengthy problem of consequences that follow the choice. Satan said something good was going to come. What really happened?
Exile.
Sorry?
Exile.
Yeah, nothing good happened. Not one thing, right? So it's interesting, if you start down from verse 8, one of the very first things it says, look at verse 10. Why did he hide?
Because they were naked.
Okay, remember I told you nakedness was going to come up again, right? What did we say at the end of chapter 2 about the nakedness and the significance of mentioning that in the text?
Everything was awesome.
Innocence, right? Everything was perfect. Man was innocent. And when they sin, what is the very first thing that we're told?
They noticed they were naked.
And they were afraid.
And afraid. And what else did they do? And they try to cover themselves. What does that imply? Shame, right? So the innocence is lost. They know what good and evil is, right? So I do think that's important, and that's a thread. That's a thread that's going to come back up again. So watch that. God calls them out, and this to me is the most fascinating thing about this consequences section. When God calls them out, pause a second, let me lead up to that a little bit. How does God call them out? What does he do? He does it in verse 9.
Ask them a question.
Yeah.
Where are you?
God is just like a parent, right? We do the same thing with our kids, right? So where were you tonight? And what are the kids wondering when we ask that? What does he know, right? And so we start this little dance between parent and child. I don't want to give all the information away because he might not know everything, right? And so God said, where are you?
But he called out to Adam.
Yeah.
He went to Adam and that's where.
Well, that's exactly right. Let me ask you a question. does God not know where they are? Why does God say, where are you?
Accountability on their part.
I think it is. It's an odd question. I don't think it's a search for information, though. When God says, where are you? The question's for Adam. God wants Adam to think about, why are you hiding in the bushes, Adam? What's the next question?
How did you know? Who told you you were naked?
Who told you that you were naked? How did you come to have this information? Have you eaten from the tree which I commanded that you not to eat? And this is what I love about the story. God confronts Adam and he says, yes, I'm a sinner. Forgive me.
What version?
And I read from the skateboard Bible. That's the only one. What does he say? The woman. Is this not dealing with children? Right? The immediate thing he does when confronted is he deflects. None of us who are grown-ups do that because we could read the story and we know that deflection does nothing because God knows where we are and what we've done, right? It's amazing how much we act like children. But what's interesting about the deflection is he doesn't just... You wonder if Adam and Eve talked about this later. He throws her under the bus with God. But he doesn't just say the woman. Why does he say that?
It's not my fault.
Isn't it interesting how desperate man is not to be at fault? That he would even blame God for the sin. Eve will be the noble one to rise up, right? She will be the one to own the sin, right?
That snake you made told me.
The snake, right? It's not me. It's the snake that tempted me. So another thing, think about all these lessons. Think about all these fundamental realities of our struggle with sin that are just bubbling to the surface as we read this story. Almost every single verse, we just see some pattern that persists all the way through the story. Deflection is one of them. Failure to own and be responsible for your sin over and over and over again. Okay, so, I'm sorry, yes?
What I was going to say is he gave full details, you know, as to what they did. Ate from the tree. What he didn't do, what he left out was he only referenced woman and not Satan. Never referenced Satan at all.
Yeah, he's going to deal with him, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
He's got a plan for that. Let's walk through this because he spells out a punishment for all the participants. So start with the serpent because that's where he begins. What's the consequence?
Cattle.
Going to eat dust?
Yep.
More importantly? Sorry?
Crawl on your belly.
Yeah. He's going to eat dust.
Hostility with man.
What's that?
Hostility with man.
Okay, hostility with men.
There's one that's going to come that's going to put you in your place.
Okay. So 3:15... You need to mark the spot in your mind. It's very cryptic. But he says to the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your seed and her seed. That's what Jill was talking about. He shall bruise you on the head and you shall bruise him on the heel. Which just kind of sounds weird. What is that?
Christ, we know that.
He's the first allusion to the solution. Somebody's coming from woman who is going to defeat the adversary, right? But in the process, you will bruise him on the heel, which is a minor wound, but he'll bruise you on the head. What is that? Yeah, the death blow. So that's a spot you want to mark, because it is the first time we have a reference, very cryptic, to the fact that Jesus is going to come and he's going to deal with the adversary. What about the woman? What are her consequences?
Having babies was easy, but now it's not going to be.
I can't believe you're the one that said that either. I kind of figured one of the ladies would want to be the one to jump on that one. So, yes, pain, childbirth, and?
She has to serve her husband. Or there's going to be conflict between her and her husband.
In the subjective role, there will be conflict. And I think that is true, because they've brought sin into the world. And now all these relationships that were, what we have at the end of chapter 2? Perfection, paradise. You're not going to have perfection in paradise anymore. And so sin, getting between a husband and wife, makes the subjective role more difficult. What about the man? He's going to work. I just read that verse and I feel Southeast Texas in July. Going to work by the sweat of his brow. Yes, sir.
He's already working, but the sweat of his brow is the added. It seems like it's the added ingredient to that.
Yeah. Where's he been living? If you don't eat, you got to work. That's exactly right. And that's...
No thorns, no thistles.
Yeah. It's not that things fundamentally change. He's still eating from the fruit of the ground. It's just how you get it. It's going to become a whole lot more different. Sin ruins everything. Ruined paradise. Because it closes with them being driven out of the garden, right? So two things with that. Separation from God, literally, physically. They're not with God in the garden anymore, and no access to the tree of life, which means you're going to die. What did God say when he warned them about eating the tree of knowledge of good and evil? The day you eat of it, you will surely die. Someone mentioned a minute ago that we, maybe Jeff said this, we learned some things about God. And one of the things we learned about God is when God says, this is how it's going to be, and this is what's going to happen, and this is exactly how it is, right? And so, from that day, first of all, they already died spiritually, but physically, they begin to die. Yes, ma'am?
I was just going to say, it also references pain, painful labor and painful toil. So, they both had
to experience. Suffer, right?
We had abundance in the garden, now they're going to be cast out where there isn't abundance, which means they could die from a lack of
and many did after that. That's exactly right. Here's the interesting thing. If you watch the biblical language as we go back through the story where God tries to deal with the problem that man created, the garden imagery comes back up, right? Even at the end of Revelation, heaven is envisioned as a return to a garden paradise. What's God doing that? What are we doing? He's saying, I need to take what you messed up, and now I need to get us back to where you were. So the Bible story is, in fact, that famous book, Paradise Lost, right? We're all getting back to the paradise that was lost, okay? All right, chapter 4. And I describe that as the spread of the disease. Again, this is going to be a biblical theme, that sin is not an isolated event, but it has this horrible tendency to spread and infect other people. And so Adam and Eve find this true with their children. So look at chapter 4. Let's talk a little bit about that. Coming about Cain and Abel. By the way, are y'all stunned about what we're not told in the Cain and Abel story? I mean, we go from Adam and Eve have some kids to the kids killing each other, right? Which may, and you know, those kids seem like a natural progression. But you don't know anything about how they grew up? What life was like on the outside? I'm kind of curious. What was the first week like out of the garden? Tell me about that. All these things we're curious about. Bible's not dealing with that. We're just getting on with the story. Yes, sir.
Can I jump back? Just real quick. Because there's something that happened before they left the garden.
Okay. You want the angel?
Animal sacrifice.
What's that?
It was an animal sacrifice for the sin. They had to have tunics made from skin, which means an animal was killed.
God does cover them because their covering was inadequate. Boy, are there some Bible themes in that? Man's attempt to cover himself is inadequate, and God has to make a sacrifice to provide a covering that is adequate. Isn't that an interesting thought to play around with?
Yeah.
You know, once you start paying attention to the fact that the Bible is a single book telling one story, you kind of go back and read everything differently. And I don't think we tend to study that way. I think we tend to isolate stuff, right? And we don't put it in the bigger context. And what happens is when you start thinking about the fact that God is telling a story, it's one story, all the way through, then all of a sudden you start wondering about details like that. Why does he tell us about the clothing? Oh, maybe there's more going on there than just the clothing, right? Yes, sir.
Well, kind of tied to what you're saying, but one thing is always kind of, maybe I just missed it all these years, which is possible, I'm dense. How did Cain to know that just what he did was not going to be acceptable? Where was the example before that, except for that?
Okay, so you're jumping back to the other side. So let's go on to chapter 4 and talk about that. So we go from they're born to they're killing each other, and it starts with worship. I think John, you were part of that too. Didn't you bring up? We're told
worship, the offerings.
They bring offerings to the Lord. And God is pleased with Abel's, he's not pleased with Cain's. What's up with Cain?
We're told exactly what's up with Cain's.
There's always one, Jeff. And that is? What is it? What was wrong with the sacrifice?
Went from the heart?
That is what he brought from the fruit of the ground, because he was a tiller of the ground. Is that the problem? It was fruit?
Yeah, faith Abel brought forth the better sacrifice. And he was blood.
So we got to know that there was some instructions on offering.
Here's the answer to the question.
Not totally.
Does it ever say that he doesn't completely disregard it, right? It just says that.
Said he had no regard for it. It was displeasing in some way, would be the point. And let me emphasize, I don't think we know. We know it was displeasing. That's what we know. I would say, Rob, that there's obviously instructions underneath that. They weren't just free to do anything, because if they were free to do anything, it wouldn't matter what they did.
Why is that?
Right? So when the Bible seems to have left out something that we think is pretty important, that's a place to stop and think. Why would we not be told that? And I think there's a reason for that. I think we would be too consumed with whatever that was in this story. And I think the point of the story is that God wasn't pleased, and that worship wasn't done right, and that's what matters. That's what we're supposed to see. What the infraction was, could have been, y'all gave some interesting thoughts about that. May well be true. Whatever that is, all of them or none of them, there were instructions that had to have been given that he didn't follow. Yes, ma'am.
Well, God obviously told him it wasn't acceptable because he got angry.
Okay,
which tells maybe part of the problem.
Maybe there's some attitude stuff going on there. Maybe so.
But I find it interesting that verse 5 says God did not respect Cain and his offering. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say he didn't respect Cain's offering, Cain and his offering.
Yeah.
So to me, that's something was there with his attitude.
Could have been. Look, I'm not denying that that's potential. I'm just saying He doesn't tell us what that is, right? But now think about the fact that he's mad. Isn't that interesting?
And what a door that opens.
Well, isn't it interesting that the people do the same thing today? I promise you, if you went to work tomorrow, talk to one of your denominational friends about what happened at their worship service, and you were to say, I am not sure that worship is authorized by God, how do you think they would feel? What would their reaction be?
They would thank you for informing them.
Thank you for exposing the folly of that. Right? That's exactly right. I have had people get mad about that. When you would think, if I messed it up, and God isn't pleased, tell me how to get it right. But that's exactly right. I noticed this reading through the story this time, that God confronts him about it. And then in verse 8 it says, Cain told Abel his brother. Isn't that interesting? That evidently they have a conversation about all of this. I also think it's interesting that God warns Cain, right? Notice, it's interesting to notice how similar Cain's story is to his mom and dad's story. Because when God confronts him, verse 6, what does God do? He asks him a question. Why are you angry? Right? And then he goes on to say, verse 7, wait, isn't this just the story of human life? Verse 7, put this on your refrigerator. If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master.
The dominion thing again.
Isn't that the story of life? Right? Do well. Don't go down that path of sin. If you do, it's trying to be your ruler. Oh, man, that's loaded. That takes us back to chapter 3.
Well, it talks about being a beast. It's crouching. It's like it's waiting for you just to misstep, and it's going to attack.
That is exactly right. Waiting to devour you. By the way, you know, here's the issue of rule again. Who's in charge?
It also goes to show that God, there's temptation out there, but nothing we can't bear. We can rule over it. Yep. He tells us right here, we can overcome it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. See, do y'all see how much is here to work with? I mean, just how much we're learning about the problem of sin that continues into this day. In fact, Adam and Eve would look at us and say, y'all haven't figured this out yet? I mean, it's been going on since the garden and after. Wish we had all that story to work with. It's interesting that God, of course, confronts Cain just like he did his parents and just like Adam and Eve, there's consequences. In fact, the consequences are interesting. The cursing of the ground and the alienation from God. Right? So same kind of problems. Okay. I want to move on. Listen, you are sitting there saying, Mark, you're going too fast. We could just, yeah, I know. We could just spend all the time talking about this. We are going to cover Genesis. We will talk about chapter 50 before we get done with this class. Talk a little bit about the genealogies, because that's what happens in chapter 4. And it is sad to me that we treat the genealogies like flyover country because the names are hard to pronounce. Let me make a suggestion to you. When you're reading the genealogies, there is typically a pattern to them. And so watch for the places where the pattern is broken. That very often helps you identify what's important about the genealogy. So the first genealogy, 17 through 24, is Adam's line. He starts it, but it's his line that runs through his son, Cain. And here's the interesting thing. 10 offspring are listed, And you just have this pattern about who was born and how long they lived and all of that. Except for the seventh in the line, which is whose? Anybody know who the seventh guy is in the line? Well, it depends if you're the Jeff school or David's traditional school. It's either Lamech or Lamech. Lamech is correct. What are we told about Lamech?
He's a bigamist.
He is?
Murderer.
And a murderer. Not just a murderer.
And he likes it.
And he likes it. He is a boastful murderer. Okay? Lamech is the epitome of the line. Does that make sense to y'all? What am I saying when I say that?
That line denied God.
Yeah.
We're no longer faithful.
This, and are you surprised by that?
No.
Yeah. Cain's family followed in the footsteps of Cain and became increasingly corrupt over time. And Lamech is sort of the poster child for that crew. By the way, is that kind of scary all a little bit when you think about your own families? See, my parents were line breakers, okay? Came from very, very, very rough circumstances, both of my parents. And they were line breakers. They forged a different direction. I'm not saying that your great-great-parents, grandparents are responsible for who we are today. I'm just saying the patterns can be set that carry on for generation after generation. Something to be thought about. All right, yes?
I was going to say, if you're looking back at, was it Mahujael and the others, you know, they built cities, they built implements or whatever. It seems like their attitude is more self-sufficiency. We don't need God. They turn to their own devices for prosperity or entertainment.
Right, so, right. And that will be a contrast to Seth's line. This was the child born after Cain and Abel, and his family is different. In fact, we're told something up front about his family that's different in chapter 4 in verse 26. What's
that? They began to call on God.
They began to call upon the name of the Lord. So these were prayerful, worshiping people, as opposed to Lamech, who is a murderous, violent man, right? Different kind of family life. So again, 10 generations, emphasis on the seventh, which is who? What is special about Enoch?
His two wives.
Sorry?
Two wives. He's married to two women.
Okay.
And he's no good.
No, no, Enoch is a good guy.
Enoch didn't die.
Sorry?
Enoch didn't die. God took him.
Yes. Don't y'all, do y'all remember this, chapter 5? Look down at verse 22. Then Enoch walked with the Lord 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters, and all the days of Enoch for 365 years, Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Interesting. Thinking of a different Enoch, I think. There's an Enoch in the other line, too, right? God took him. So he's the epitome of Seth's line. A guy that doesn't see death, but is caught up. Man, I've got so many questions about that, too. Am I just weird, or are y'all like that? Do you read these stories and think, oh, man, couldn't you have just, like, added two more verses about what that looked like?
But like you said, if we got that, we wouldn't be as thoughtful. Because not knowing makes us examine ourselves more, I think.
Yeah, there are, there is value sometimes in the mystery, right? We'll see that as we go through all of this. So, with the two genealogies, you know, we're kind of rolling up to chapter 6 now, because that is setting the stage for the flood. Because which lineage is lost in the flood? Cain's. Yeah. His lineage is lost in the flood. and it's Seth's, well, a little remnant of Seth's family, not get ahead of ourselves, is the one that survives. Another thing I want you to notice in chapter 5, there's this interesting pattern, with the exception of Enoch. He breaks the pattern. Look at verse 18 of chapter 5. Jared lived 162 years, and he became the father of Enoch. And Jared lived 800 years after he became the father of Enoch. And he had other sons and daughters, and all the days of Jared were 962 years. And? Yeah. So that's kind of the pattern. There's the name. There's the time to the first child, and then the child is named, who will be next in the list, and then we're told about the additional years and the other children, and then the total number of years. But in chapter 5, it adds that phrase, and he died. Does anybody else find that odd? And he died, and he died, and he died, and he died. It does it over and over and over again. What's that?
No matter how long you live, you're going to die.
Yes, and usually, if I were to say to you, my great-grandfather lived 97 years, I don't need to say, and he died, right? In fact, you would thought that, think that was kind of oddly redundant, because lived 97 years necessarily implies that there was not a 98th, right? Mm-hmm. And in a lot of the biblical genealogies, that's the way it worked. He lived this many years, period, the end of sentence. Yes, sir?
Go back to chapter 3. You will not surely die, said Sir. And he died. And he died. I think it's just kind of a book and that part of the story there.
Lest you forget.
Lest you forget.
Because it's not the way it was supposed to be. Right? And in the middle of Seth's line, we have Enoch, who was a good man, and he did not die. So why are we told that? He did not die. He went to be with God. Why are we told that?
Faithful.
Maybe when they just say, and then he died, like some scriptures say, he went to sleep with his fathers, meaning their father, grandfather. Maybe, and then he died not where he didn't go. Maybe it wasn't this, you know, maybe he was buried in a way that...
This is a reference to the fact that physical...
It is a short reference.
Yeah, that physical death took place. Again, here's the point. It's not the way it's supposed to be, okay? But with Enoch, he didn't die, but he went to be with God. That is the way it's supposed to be. See it?
Just as he was not.
Yes.
It's like his wife wakes up.
Because God took him, right? And so I think what you have, Stephen mentioned, you know, we're kind of at the bookend of this before we get to the flood. This is God saying, this is what I intended. And you guys mess it up. Yes, Kevin, what do you want to get on?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it's a precursor to Christ. We ourselves are covered by the blood of Christ. We are now with God. We won't die, for God will take us. That's all.
And that is the end of the story, right? That's the end of the story. That we are supposed to go back with God in what is described in Revelation as paradise. So the story is about how to get back there. I just think 5 makes this interesting. You know, in the middle of this name list, there's this interesting message tucked in here where God is saying, I didn't design it to be this way. Death is an odd thing, not the way it's supposed to be. I designed it to be like Enoch. I wanted you to be good and be with me. All right, John, you probably got the last word here.
Do you think the way Enoch walked with God was the same way Adam walked with God?
No.
Okay.
No, remember, outside the garden now.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so all that has changed. So let me tell you what's happened. Now we've got the plot to the story, right? Man has introduced this very destructive problem. We're going to really get how bad that is. And we've added a new character, the adversary, right? Now we've got to deal with Satan. He's creating these problems. Next week, 6, 7, and 8, and we're going to get to the flood story. So take a look at those chapters.